Do not love the world. Those opening words of the section that we're considering in 1 John chapter 2 and verses 15 through 17 highlight John's concern for his readers. Ultimately, the issue is whether we really have fellowship with God. That is John's ultimate concern in this letter. He has already addressed in various ways the claims of the false teachers of his day, who seem to be claiming that it is possible to have fellowship with God while living in darkness. Those are John's terms, perhaps rather than their own, but they are terms that reflect the reality of their lives. If we say we have fellowship with him while we walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth, he said in chapter 1 and verse 6. Whoever says, I know him, but does not keep his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him, he said in chapter 2 and verse 4. John's concern for his readers is to establish with them whether or not they have real fellowship with God. Now, in our last study in this book, we considered verses 12 through 14, and we observed a slight digression that John made there in seeking to give his own assessment of where his readers stood before God. And he drew their attention to evidences that he saw in their lives that demonstrated that they really were children of God. Whether they were older in the faith and more mature, or whether they were young and just starting out with incredible zeal, he could see in their lives evidences that they were children of God. But nevertheless, he sees it necessary to return to a theme that he has already begun. This theme of fellowship with God that is evidenced by our obedience to his commands, or walking with darkness, which is evidenced by our failure to obey the commands of God. Now, he's spoken about the need to love God. He's spoken about the demonstration of our love for God being evident in the way that we react to other people. In other words, that the supreme demonstration of our love for God is not the words that we use, I love God, but the lives that we live in relation to others of the children of God. Do we love them? Is our love for God evident in the way that we love them? Now John flips the coin over and he considers the other side. Positively, we are to love God and our brothers and sisters in the faith. Whoever loves his brother abides in the light, he has said, and in him there is no cause for stumbling. We are to love. On the other side of the coin, there are things that we are not to love. Do not love the world or the things in the world. Who or what is the world? And what kind of love is being spoken of here? Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. It seems that there is a contrast being made between our love of the world, whatever that may be, and our love of the Father. Our love for the world and our love for God are in contrast to each other, and they're diametrically opposed to each other. You cannot have one and the other, is what John is saying. We cannot love the world and love God. Now, we are perhaps beginning to hear echoes of Jesus' own teaching that we cannot serve God and mammon or money. In other words, we have to choose between two loyalties that are opposed to one another and cannot coexist together. Our love for God, God's love for us, and the love of God worked out through us in our relationship with others needs to be so clearly evident in our lives that there is no room for any flirting with the world. So what then does he mean by the world? And what does it mean to love the world? Well, he really answers his own question in verse 16. It provides a kind of an explanation of what he's referring to when he says, "Do not love the world or the things in the world." In verse 16 he says, "For all that is in the world is not from the Father, but is from the world." What are those things that are in the world? Well, he refers to them with a threefold designation: the desires of the flesh, and the desires of the eyes, and pride in possessions. So let's consider these three aspects of the world that John is encouraging, no more than that, commanding us that we ought not to love. Firstly, the desires of the flesh. We live in a world in which my pleasure rather than God's glory is the focus of most people. We live in a world, particularly in our Western worlds where there is so much affluence, we live in a world where people live for pleasure. They live for self-gratification. And John says, don't love the world. Don't embrace the world's values. Don't live as people in the world live, for themselves, for the desires of the flesh. Don't allow this mentality, which drives people to live their lives for the pleasures that each day offers, rather than to live their lives for the glory of God. Don't allow that temptation to take hold in your life. And don't be deceived by this world's philosophies that would encourage you to do so. This really was the beginning of the fall of mankind. You remember in Genesis chapter 3 how the serpent came and spoke to the woman, questioning what God had said to her. And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You shall not surely die. God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" And listen to what verse 6 says. "So, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate." Here was a tree that when she looked upon it, having heard the words of the serpent, was good for food. It would meet her bodily needs for nourishment. Now, it's not as if there were any other trees in the garden that were good for food, is it? But she would have to go and eat from this tree. But there you are, you see, that's the subtleties of Satan. And that's the deceptiveness of this world. This world will say, it's a legitimate thing. It's okay. You have this need. Meet this need. It's a right desire. Fulfill this desire. God made you this way. He wouldn't expect you not to satisfy these desires, so satisfy them. And just like Eve in Eden, we see things that are a delight to the eyes. We forget the legitimate ways that God has given to us to satisfy our needs and to meet our right desires. And we do what Eve did, and we stretch out our hands and we take that which is forbidden, though it may well look good for food. It may seem to us to be that which will best satisfy us at any particular moment. But that which looked good for food was in fact rotten to the core. Not that the fruit in and of itself was rotten, but the fact that it was forbidden fruit made it rotten fruit. It would not give life. It would bring death. It would not bring pleasure. It would bring pain. It would not satisfy. Rather, it would in fact leave her feeling intensely dissatisfied. And is that not true with the pleasures that this world so often extends to us? When we take of that which is not permitted by God, we often find that the promise of satisfaction somehow misses us, is unfulfilled. There's an appearance of goodness to it, but those desires remain unquenched. Do not love the world. Do not love the desires of the flesh. The term desires here is used about 38 times in the New Testament, and all but three of those times it is used negatively. It's used of that which is sinful or inappropriate. And so here, when it's talking about the desires of the flesh, it's talking about that which is sinful, that which God has forbidden. We live in a world in which the good gifts that God has given to us are twisted and perverted and corrupted. Or they're given an inappropriate place of prominence. And so we live, for example, in an age of sex outside marriage. That which is good in and of itself, in an appropriate context, is evil. It's sinful in an inappropriate context. We live in a world of gluttony and drunkenness, of overindulgence. Nothing wrong with eating and drinking. Where there's moderation, But we live in a world that doesn't know self-control, that feeds every desire and satiates itself. We live in a society where people work in order to play. In other words, the focus of their daily routine is to get to the weekend and enjoy themselves. That's what they live for. But God placed man in this world to live for his glory and to find their enjoyment in him. That doesn't mean that it's wrong to go off to the ski slopes at the weekend and to enjoy God's creation in that way, or whatever way it is that gives you satisfaction. The point that is being made here is that the desires of the flesh become a consuming focus of life, you see. And things are distorted and blown out of their proper proportion in life. And that which in and of itself is good becomes evil because we misapply it and we misappropriate it. So the desires of the flesh are part of this idea of the world and the things in the world that we are not to love. Secondly, he goes on to talk about the desires of the eyes. And I think very closely related to the first, and some in fact would say that the desires of the flesh are the big picture, as it were, and then the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions are aspects of that desire of the flesh. Well, here we have a world in which covetousness has become a controlling passion. People see and they want. But I think it's saying more than that. I think it has contained in it the idea that what we see with our eyes becomes the dominant reality of our lives. In other words, that what we are able to see is what becomes the focus of our living. Now, if we understand the scriptures rightly, we realize that what we're able to see is not the ultimate reality. That which we can see, that which we can smell, that which we can touch and taste, these things are real, but there's something as real, even if we have to use a word like spiritual to refer to it. It doesn't make it any less real. The fact that our eyes cannot perceive it, the fact that our ears cannot sense it, the fact that we cannot lay our hands on it and touch it or put it to our lips and taste it does not mean that the spiritual realm is any less real than the material. Rather, the Bible would tell us that it is the spiritual realm that is the ultimate and enduring reality. That it is the spiritual realm that we ought to have our lives focused upon, not the material realm. But you see, the desires of the eyes focus upon the physical, the material. Eve, looking at that fruit in the garden, saw not only that it was desirable for food, but that it was a delight to the eyes. But it was all just appearance, wasn't it? The substance was death. If you eat of the fruit of that tree, however nourishing it may look, however pleasing to the eyes it may appear, you will surely die. You see, there's a greater reality than the reality of that fruit hanging on a tree looking so delicious. There's the reality of God. There's reality of his commands. And there's a reality of his justice against those who disobey him. Well, we need to live our lives in the context of that reality, not just what we can fix our eyes upon. We need to have our lives controlled by the substantial things, not just the appearance. It reminds me of a scene in Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, where two sisters, Jane and Elizabeth, are discussing two young men, Mr. Wickham and Mr. Darcy. And I don't remember their exact words, but their conversation went something along these lines. The one man has all the appearance of goodness, and the other man has the goodness without the appearance of it. Mr. Darcy was so often misunderstood. He seemed to be a proud man, an unfeeling man, with no generosity of heart or spirit. Whereas Mr. Wickham was everyone's friend. Everyone loved him. Everyone wanted him in their homes, and everyone wanted their daughter to marry him. But he was rotten to the core. One had all the appearance of goodness, and the other one had the goodness without the appearance of it. Now, so much of what we look at in our lives is like that. It seems to be good. It seems to be innocent. It seems to be fine. But because we miss the reality of the spiritual realm and we don't factor that into our view of life, we're often, sadly, misled. It's no wonder then that we live in a world in which advertisers successfully prey on gullible people. People who don't think straight. And so the latest fashion must be obtained. It doesn't matter that last year's fashion is still perfectly wearable. We have to have what's in today. We have to have the new house, the new car, the new computer, the new gadget, the new appliance, the new experience. We have to go to the latest restaurants, the currently popular holiday resort. People live their lives for these things. And I would hazard a guess that even if I haven't mentioned it, there is something in your lives that is a real temptation in this respect. Do not love the world, or the things in the world, the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes. Thirdly, pride in possessions. Again, closely related to that which has gone before. Some translations say the pride of life, for the term life or possessions can be variously translated and does include both. We find it in 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 17. But if anyone has the world's goods, possessions, it's the same word, and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Well, pride in possessions, or the pride of life. We live in a world in which achievement and success is measured by material rather than spiritual gain. It's reflected in the New Testament, for example, in Luke's Gospel, chapter 12, and in verse 15, Jesus says, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Or again, in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 6, in his Sermon on the Mount, in verses 19 through 21, Jesus taught, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." You may have seen the bumper sticker, "He who dies with the most toys wins." That's the philosophy of many in this life. They live for the possessions they can amass during their lives. But what happens to the person with few possessions and the person with heaps of possessions when they die? Well, they both take exactly the same with them. Nothing. To use the words of Job, "Naked I came into this world, and naked shall I depart." And yet, all around us, we see evidence of this pride in possessions. But let me use for a moment that idea of pride of life, just to broaden it out a little bit beyond that which we can handle, if you like. I think he's talking about pride not only in what we can accumulate in the garage, or in the house, or in the garden, but also pride in what we achieve by our own efforts. Pride in our success. Pride in our ability to climb the corporate ladder. Pride in our ability to win arguments. In a sense, that was part of the problem for Eve as well, wasn't it? We've already seen the desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes reflected in those words. When the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes, but we're also told that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. What James tells us is that if we want to be wise, we ask God. What Eve decided was, if she wanted to be wise, she would have to do it herself. And it's so easy for us to fall into that trap of thinking, of becoming proud of our own abilities. And that, in a sense, is at the root of mankind's rebellion against God. I'll do it my way. And of course, my way is a way that is earthbound. And so it becomes a world in which the material is elevated over the spiritual. And God eventually is pushed right out of the picture completely. John says, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. This is his concern. The ultimate issue is whether we really have fellowship with God. And what John is saying is, if you love the world, if your life is governed by desires of the flesh and the desires of the eyes and pride in possessions, then you don't have the love of God in you. You don't have fellowship with God. And the tragedy of all this is expressed in verse 17. The world is passing away along with its desires. The world is on the way out. John's already used similar language in chapter 2 and verse 8. Where speaking of the new commandment, he says, the darkness is passing away and the true light is already shining. The world is passing away and its desires. It's already happening. Because Jesus Christ has come. Because he's set new values for us to follow. New priorities to govern our lives. Priorities that put God back in the center of our lives where he ought to have been all along. Spiritual reality is replacing the material mirage that so haunts many people in this world. And we need to pursue the reality and not the mirage. We need to have God as the focus of our lives. Love for him rather than love for this world. Because whoever does the will of God, John tells us, abides forever. It is the will of God that will bring permanence. And so our desires, our affections need to be set upon God and upon his will. Or to use Paul's terminology in chapter 3 of Colossians, if then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. Let us remember, this world is passing away. Let us live for that which lasts. That doesn't mean that we don't find incredible pleasure and enjoyment in life. God has given us all things richly to enjoy. He's given us this beautiful world to live in and to enjoy, to get great pleasure from, but let it never be to the exclusion of the God who made it and the God who gave it to us. Let us put him first, and then all of these other things will rightly fall into their proper place, and we will enjoy them all the more, and we will have the assurance of God's presence and pleasure forever.